the director of GLOW here at the DCJCC, the Curlander Program for GLBT Outreach and Engagement. And I am so excited that we are going to be kicking off this morning the Hyman S. and Frieda Bernstein Jewish Literary Festival. And I am thrilled that you are all here to see the incredible Joy Ladin in conversation with Susan Weidman-Schneider. Thank you to the DCJCC board members and founding chair of the festival, Tamara Handelsman and her husband, Harry Handelsman, for everything they have done to continue to support this festival. I'd also like to take a moment to recognize Lily Kalish-Gersh and Ellie Lichtwein, the wonderful festival staff here, and our amazing volunteers, and especially Debbie Carliner and Michael Singer, festival co-chairs. Thank you to our community co-sponsors, Moment Magazine and Lilith Magazine. And it is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Dana Beyer to tell us more about today's guests. Dana is the Executive Director of Gender Rights Maryland and is a force to be reckoned with as an advocate for LGBT civil rights and many other issues. She was a candidate for Maryland's state delegate, and we are extremely fortunate to have her with us on the advisory board here at GLOW. Dana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. This is quite an honor for me. Joy has meant a lot to me in my life personally, which is one of the reasons I was asked to speak. I'll get to that in a minute. First, Susan Weidman-Schneider is the author of three acclaimed books, Jewish and Female, the first book to take a comprehensive look at Jewish women's special concerns, Intermarriage, the Challenge of Living with Differences Between Christians and Jews, and Head to Heart About Money in the Lives of Women. Susan and Lilith have been awarded a Polyakov Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. She has also been honored with Hadassah's Golden Wreath Award and American Jewish Congress's Eleanor Roosevelt Prize, and by the American Jewish Press Association, Synagogue Sisterhoods, B'nai B'rith, and Brandeis University. The Israel Women's Network and American Jewish Congress have honored her in the Knesset as one of a handful of women, including Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to receive the Jewish Women Who Have Made a Difference Award. Most importantly, Susan is the founder and the longtime executive director of Lilith. And that is a remarkable phenomenon because being editor-in-chief of anything for so many years is just generally unheard of in the publishing industry. I remember when Lilith first came out, I was a junior in medical school, so this goes way back. This is from the bicentennial. So she's been editor-in-chief since 1976. Talk about institutional memory, and I'm sure we will benefit from that as we move forward. Now, Joy is a professor at Yeshiva University, which really should be all you need to know, because just think about this. There is a trans woman who is a professor at Yeshiva University. Whoever would have imagined this to be possible? It's happened because Joy is a remarkable person, also very astute, and she got tenure before she transitioned. Always a very smart thing to do. In addition, she was fortunate that Yeshiva University is in New York City, which has anti-discrimination laws, which compounds the problems for the administration at a place like Yeshiva that really wasn't too comfortable with this phenomenon. Most of the people here who are gay or trans know what it's like to be in the closet. And it's one thing when you finally realize you're not alone. It's another thing when you realize there's actually somebody else almost exactly like you out there. It's interesting how finally knowing that there was another trans person in the world was a huge breakthrough. But then when I discovered that there was actually another woman who was raised as an Orthodox Jew in the world, that was absolutely stunning. There's a small irony here because generally, when it comes to trans rights, the reform movement has taken the lead in this country. And everybody would assume that to be the case because they're the most secular of all of our denominations. But back in the 70s, it was actually Orthodox Judaism. Actually, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who was Israel's leading biomedical ethicist, who ruled in a response that being trans is sort of okay. Not that he was going to encourage people to transition, but You know, in Judaism and the Talmud, you see this a lot. Well, you've already done it. You seem to be okay. We'll accept you and then move on from there. And to me, that was a life-saving response to have read back in 1974, I think it was. Berkeley. And I can't imagine now, that I haven't talked about this with others, but I can't imagine that I was the only one who noticed that. And it was only 30 years later that I worked with the conservative movement to make them responsive to the issues of the trans community and to embrace the trans community as well. So in some bizarre manner, Orthodox Jewry has actually been at the forefront. And it's not surprising when you look back 2,000 years that you'll find in the Gemara a recognition that sexuality is a little bit more complex than the phrases that our opposition, say, our marriage equality, Marilyn used, that God created a man and a woman. We all know from our history and our studies of the Torah that it's a little bit more complicated than that. And the rabbis 2,000 years ago knew various forms of intersex, not only in their animal husbandry work, but also in their human sexuality work. So we do have a long history of acceptance and understanding. At times it gets overwhelmed. At times it is allowed to flourish. And this is a period of time where the flourishing has been manifest, particularly in the presence and in the work of Professor Joy Ladin, who is a wonderful poet and has written an incredible memoir and does very, very well in representing all of us. I'm also honored to have her on the board of Keshet, which many of you know here. It's the National Jewish LGBT Outreach Organization, where she's doing wonderful work to help make the Jewish community more welcoming of the entire LGBT community. So it's my pleasure, my honor, to welcome Susan and Joy for a conversation.
Thank you, Dana, for that introduction, but also for the incredible work that you've been doing.
And I thank you also. It was wonderful to hear when we were speaking a little just before the program got started that, Dana, you remembered a special issue Lilith Magazine had done on transgender Jews from 2002. So one of the questions that I will have, I think, for both of you later on is, what should we be talking about? Sorry, a little too close to the mic. What should we be talking about now, 10 years later? What has changed? Can I do a brief commercial announcement for your book?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How's the mic? Have I moved this too close? How's the sound? We're okay? We're good? Okay. The book is absolutely fabulous, and I thought I knew many aspects of Joy's story. We had had Joy as our cover girl a few issues back, and that issue is a sellout. The book is a really remarkable piece of both memoir and analysis. And I can't commend it to you highly enough. I was both so moved and so instructed by your journey. And in particular, and maybe you can say something about this, by your insights looking back, that you can describe so vividly what it was like to be a pre-adolescent boy, what it was like to be a boy in early teen years doing heavy sports and hurting yourself. And just to be able to describe both your life in the near present, or the near present, I guess we can't have the near present, it's either the present or the near past. You're describing both your life now analytically, but also to be able to think back and to process with really extraordinary vividness what it was like to be that boy.
Thank you. One thing that I haven't actually asked other trans people about this, but I have a tremendous difficulties remembering most of my life, and I remember a lot of it, my life as a male, kind of in the third person. My memories are sort of photographed from a distance. So a lot of what makes memory vivid is the bodily experience, the way things smell, the way things taste. when my kids were small and they would say, so tell us stories about when you were little. I had like three. One of them involved eating a Pop-Tart that I really liked. And so when I was working on the book, it was both hard but also this incredible gift to me to try to engage in the act of remembering and to have a self in the present that could go back and try to do this work of re-inhabiting and reclaiming these moments in my life for myself, because I spent so much of that time that I've been writing about saying, this isn't me, this isn't really me. So part of what was amazing in writing the book was to go back and say, well, actually, in some ways that I still can't say that I fully understand, this is me, this is my life, and there's more of it in there than I had let myself realize. Marcel Proust, I actually read Remembrance of Things Past. This is one of the things, I should put it on my Vita or something.
Yes.
You know, there's so much that I haven't read.
It's a missed opportunity.
About it, but yeah. So I actually read it, and a lot of it is about the act of remembering, which made it very exotic to me. One of the incredible things he says is that we don't really live until we've remembered. Like, he didn't put much store in going to parties and meeting people and stuff. That's what he devoted his 20s to, but when he got too sick to do that and he was sitting and writing and remembering, that's when he felt like his life was really opening up. And his publisher kept sending him proofs, and he kept writing more and more in the lines between the lines, because the more he remembered, the more he remembered. So in a sense, he felt that the present was very limited, but the past was infinitely rich. And I don't know if that's generally true, but it really is true for me that a lot of my life was sort of unlived when I was going through it, and the writing process has been a way of trying to come fully alive through time.
I think I was also struck in some of our earlier conversations about the remarkable nuanced way that you can look now at male and female experience. We talked about this. We had the pleasure in New York a while back of having Joy at a Lilith salon. There are now about 100 of these Lilith salons that meet around the country in various cities, some of them in colleges here on college campuses in the D.C. area. And we almost, I won't say almost never, but rare is the opportunity to have one of Lilith's featured authors present at a salon. So, of course, people were just totally engaged by Joy. And one of the most memorable aspects of that conversation had to do with your description of not having been socialized as a woman. And I don't know if you recall those particular questions, but will you say a little more about that?
Well, one thing is, you know, when you... whenever you're facing uncertainty in employment, it helps to have a plan B. So when I was trying to find out if I was going to be able to continue in my career as a teacher after I came out, I had tenure, and New York City did have a human rights law that covered gender identity and expression, but at the same time, nobody actually knew if an Orthodox Jewish institution would be able to handle having an openly transgender professor. And I have to say, it's a testimony to the people that I work with, to this school, and to my students above all, that I'm able to be there. It's not just, they didn't have to take me back. I could have been bought, you know, seven figures, eight figures. Maybe we could have talked. But instead, they actually found a way to reconceive of the culture and to accept me. And, you know, so I work very closely with students, and I often want to ask them, like, how can you do this? But I think that the answer is, well, we're raised to really respect the image of God in which human beings are created. And even when those human beings seem strange to us, that's still our job. So I feel pretty lucky to be there. But anyway, I didn't know if that was going to work. So my plan B was to be a marriage counselor because, you know, specifically heterosexual marriage counselor, because I could say, well, when I was a husband and this came up, I felt this way. And, you know, now it looks that way. So that is a service that I've offered my friends. One of the, you know, the experience of being included in Lilith that way was, that was tremendous. Maybe we'll talk more about the experience, but part of what was great about it was I grew up really feeling that I was on the outside of gender. I felt that I was, you know, I was accepted as a male, but I didn't feel like I really was a male, so I felt like I was pretending and that I was always in danger of being found out if I wasn't doing a good enough imitation. And I also felt like, you know, I wasn't really female. You know, I wasn't a woman trapped in a man's body because I'd never had a chance to grow up female and become a woman. I'd never made any choices as a woman. I'd never been treated as a woman. And there's a strain in feminist thinking that is pretty anti-trans woman for reasons that actually a lot of trans women read this book because it was one of the only things, if you looked up transsexual in the card catalog, this is right, I grew up when there were card catalogs. So one of the only things you would find was a book called The Transsexual Empire by Janice Raymond, which is, you know, kind of a paranoid rant, but also presenting an argument that it has a lot of meaning for some women against the idea that trans women should be accepted as women, particularly by feminists. And the, you know, at root, the argument is something like, yeah, you know, this is really the ultimate in male privilege. Only a man could come up with the idea that when you get tired of being a man, then you get to call yourself a woman and insist that women accept you as a woman, because that'll make you feel good. And so that was something that was a voice that I grew up with in my head, and I used it to keep myself from transitioning, to tell myself that I was not legitimate. And there's an additional version of it that someone shared with me. She said, you know, when I go into a women's only space and I see a trans woman who feels to me like a man, you know, I was sexually abused. I look to these spaces as refuges, as places that I can go to escape this kind of traumatic sexual violence that I grew up in. And what I find instead is here's somebody who feels to me like a man asking me to make them feel comfortable, which is something that I'm always asked to do with men as a woman. So Janice Raymond gave me the theory, and this woman was generous enough to tell me this sort of visceral level. But on the whole, you know, I had felt like that feminism was not a place where I would be welcomed or seen as real, you know. So to be included in Lilith was both an honor, but it was healing in this kind of way. And I thought as over the past few years about what do people get out of including trans people? Because I probably shouldn't say this, but you know, we're a pain in the butt. We really are. So where we go, you need to, yeah, but you know, you have to redesign your bathrooms, you have to change your policies. My synagogue, which considers itself extremely progressive, when my daughter had a bat mitzvah, my ex wanted the children called to the Torah by my male name. And I said that was really not acceptable. And the poor rabbi was being shouted at by both parents. Said, well, we don't have a policy about that. And I said, well, you have a policy that says you welcome transgender people, and this is what it means. You know, you can't, unless you want to change the policy to say you welcome us until somebody's uncomfortable with our identity, you're going to have to come up with new policies. But people really do have to come up with new policies, and we're a tiny minority. So, you know, there are like 2 or 3 trans people in this entire community. So how much institutional energy do you devote to reimagining yourself for a tiny minority? And I think this question comes up a lot. With regard to women, I think one of the things that women can get, I've given up on the question of what I am, frankly. I can't cut myself open and compare my inner gender identity to those of people who were born and raised as women. Oh, no, right? Mine might look the same as yours, it might be different, but there's no way for me to tell. What I do know is I lived as a man, and now I live as a woman. And I'm trying to be myself. So that's where I've come down. But for women to include trans women among women, with all of the difficulties that that brings up, what do you get? And one of the things that you get is you get to see what a woman looks like when she is not raised in fear. Mm. Right? When she does not grow up battered by the male gaze. Right? When she doesn't grow up thinking, actually, guys are probably really are smarter, even though I know that I'm smarter, right, with those kinds of built-in insecurities. So I was socialized male. I didn't want to be socialized male, but I don't have any of those built-in reflexes to doubt myself or subordinate myself. The way I walk, I'm told, and I think this, it's just not, like, I don't walk like I might be raped, right, or harassed. I could be, but it seems unlikely. But, you know, this is something that if you grow up as a woman in this culture, you better grow up knowing that this can happen to you. And that breeds habits of fear and insecurity that it's hard for many women to imagine themselves without. So if you welcome trans women, you say, yeah, trans women are women also. I think by broadening that definition, it creates some problems. But what you get is a vision of how women could be if they didn't grow up in this shadow of male violence.
I think that's just brilliantly said, and I think it gets enacted in lives in many ways, not just in the way you walk down the street, Joy, but in the way you describe yourself in faculty meetings, where you said once that you do not suffer fools gladly. You do not silence yourself when someone says something absurd that you're comfortable saying. Mm-hmm. You're wrong. Whereas many of us socialize differently, first wait for someone, not all of us, but some of us, perhaps waiting for someone of the male persuasion to say it first or to. So that, I think that was very illuminating, and I appreciated that, and I learned that from you. But I also think, you know, when you say, oh, to welcome trans people into the community, it's a pain because you need separate bathrooms and so on. The accommodations are rather slight, but what I found difficult 10 years ago when we edited this first batch of articles, some by trans men, some by trans women, did a lot of interviews and so on, I called a woman. Someone said to me, you have to speak to Rachel Pollack. A woman I didn't know, I phoned her and I said, I've been told I should speak to you to get some insights into the trans world for a Jewish person. Are you familiar with Lilith magazine? She said to me, yes, you've published my poetry, don't you remember? So, So I'm sorry, I didn't remember. But we began to speak and we began to meet quite the life. She had transitioned many years before. And I said to her, after we spoke a while, I said, she had also grown up Orthodox, interesting. And I said, I'm having a lot of difficulty because some of the trans men I'm editing, I'm really finding very resistant. I mean, not resistant when we're talking about the guts of what they're speaking. I'm not challenging them on their experience, but when I say this sentence really needs a semicolon, they were very, very difficult. And Rachel said to me, very sympathetic, she said, Susan, please remember they're all on testosterone. You know, like this was supposed to be the explanation. And I think that they're, it was interesting that, still seeing the world sort of in binary and chemical terms. And I thought about that the other day and about how in that conversation 10 years ago, it was sort of a challenge to have insights into the experience of transgender Jews. And I was reminded of how far the community has come when a couple of years ago we had with many interns at Lilith, we've had about 150 in the years, the MAG 35 years after all, many of whom have gone on to do really interesting work, and they tend to stay in good touch. One of them from a couple of years ago, a trans man, had certain terrific skills that we thought we needed as we're launching a new Lilith website in about a month. We were desperate to get some stuff done, and one of our editors said, "Oh, let's call Al. This will be great." And Al, who now goes as Simcha, and is part of a wonderful band called Schmeckel, which I think has appeared here. So Simcha came back and was coming in regularly to help us restructure this website. And then comes our next new intern, a lovely young woman, fresh out of her college experience, and she's sitting at our conference table doing some work. And one of the editors comes in and says to me, "Well, you know, Simcha is coming in this afternoon." I said, "Great." She said, "They'll be here at about 2. And I said, "Wait, more people are coming?" No. She said, "They'll be here at 2. And then I remembered that Simcha does not like he or she as a pronoun and prefers they. So, and I've said many times, I have no difficulty around gender identity. I have a huge amount of trouble wrapping my head around altering pronouns in the English language. I have a real, it's a huge challenge for me." So this editor left, and I thought, you know, I should prepare the new intern for Simcha walking in, for the pronoun challenges, for the fact that Simcha, who presents as male, is, but I should give this new intern at least some sense. So I said, my confusion of the pronoun, Simcha is transitioning from female to male and it prefers neutral pronouns like they and their instead of he or his, her. And Miriam looks up from what she said, and she said, "Oh, yeah, 3 of my closest friends are transitioning. You know, I get it." She was absolutely, this was completely part of her universe. And, you know, they hang out together and do their thing in the office. But it was very interesting that what I thought I would need to explain to this person who's, you know, 22 years old and a couple of months out of Mount Holyoke, of course, right? Okay. But I found that refreshing. Because one of the first questions that you ask or get asked when a baby is born is it a boy or a girl? I mean, the Talmud, as we just heard from Dana, you know, recognizes many different genders, 5 genders at least. You know, there's male and female and a whole spectrum in between. You know, different ritual roles even in early Judaism assigned to people of different genders, much like in American Indian culture or, you know, Tiresias for the ancient Greeks as somebody who understood male and female. But it was, to me, fascinating that some of this has penetrated this thinking. So I wanted to ask you as I was reading the book, and I don't know if any of you have had the pleasure of reading the book yet, but when you're asked to read from the book or when you're asked to name a particular experience that for you seems to be the most vivid representation of your transition, what do you choose to read?
Wow, nobody's ever asked me to do that before. Bummer.
Now this is an instance where you should sort of prep the prep your colleague.
I was just curious. You know, this is a question to which I think I would give different answers at different times. So one of the things about the book is that a lot of it was written in the midst of transition, and partly as I was always somebody, you know, as I grew up, writing was my way of feeling like I was really there, right? So when I could be there in a way that didn't involve a body, that was when I felt like I was most there. And it was through poetry. And when I started the transition process and everything was, you know, all the structures in my life, it wasn't just the gender stuff, everything was really falling apart, writing was a way that I was partly trying to sort things out, but more than that, I was trying to compose myself, as they say. I mean, I really was trying to literally make myself up, partly by saying I, which was a pronoun that was suddenly meaning a whole bunch of different things. Like, what does I mean when you all you know is you're now consider yourself a former man? Right? So, but I didn't feel like I was anybody yet because I wasn't, I was still, you know, really nascent. The other is that I got to write about a lot of stuff in the past tense, even though I was sort of in the midst of it. And when you write, when you tell a story in the past tense, you split yourself into two. There's the schlamazel of your past self, who, as you're telling the story, oh, and then I locked my car, my keys in my car, right? That poor past self is just stumbling along chronologically through the story you're telling. But there is the transcendent eye of the storyteller, who already knows how this is going to come out, and that's how I met the person that I later married, or whatever it is, right? So you split yourself into these two different perspectives, and one knows nothing, and the other knows everything. And I really needed to pretend that there was some perspective from which all of this made sense, from which I would make sense and I would understand it. So just like by writing I was, that kind of created this false but hopeful sense that there was going to be a perspective that where I was distant from these events. So in a way, each of the chapters that I wrote seemed to me like the quintessential transition experience at the time that I wrote them, and I consider myself to still be in transition, and now there are other things that I would say. One of the ones that to me is most important in terms of my relationship to Judaism and Jewish space is the section where in one of the chapters I do something which I guess all of us are supposed to do this. If you're, at least if you're a member of a synagogue, you're supposed to tell the story of your trip to Israel, right? Right? That seems to be, you're not really Jewish until you've stood up and told the story of your trip to Israel to people. So I had two different trips to Israel. One was when I went there with my family on a Fulbright scholarship as a husband and a father with children. I was teaching as a guy. And the other was right after the New York Post article about the, you know, amusing spectacle of a transsexual coming back to teach at Yeshiva University came out. And I kind of fled to Jerusalem, where my best friend lives. And I went to the Wailing Wall. And I'd gone there with kids and with my ex, and now I was going as a guy, and I had not felt like I was really there. It was pretty standard, so I was dissociated. Most of my life I'd been dissociated. One of the great things for me about having kids was I got to, like, hold them. There was this physical feeling of love that was strong enough to penetrate the numbness. And conveniently, my daughter, older daughter, who was 2 at the time, she refused to set foot in Israel. She had a really strange reaction. She just would not walk. She'd been running all over the place in the U.S., but she had some sort of traumatic reaction. We didn't have a stroller. So I carried her everywhere. So I'm carrying her through the streets of Jerusalem, and because I was dissociated, it just didn't hurt that much. And because I was dissociated, I really welcomed this feeling of the weight of her. It made me feel like I was more there. And when we got to the wall, of course, I had to hand her to my ex, because the wall is divided into, you know, it's divided by gender. And I went with my son, who, we didn't do a lot of things, I mean, other than going into men's rooms, which was, he was very disappointed when I refused at a certain point in transition. I said, you know, Gabriel, I really can't go in there with you anymore. And he's like, why not? I said, well, you know, I think that they'll, like, you know, throw me out or beat me up. He's like, why, Daddy? It's like, never mind, just other people see me differently than you do, trust me on this. But, you know, other than that, there really wasn't stuff that we did as where we were in a group of guys, and that was it. So we split off and we went to the men's side. And so I felt like I was doing this incredibly identity-affirming thing and going to the Wailing Wall, which is at the center of my identity as a Jew. and I'm doing something with my son, who I suddenly realized he was growing up. Now he started college, but then I realized in a couple of years he'd be having a bar mitzvah, and somehow that hadn't occurred to me until then. And at the same time, I felt like I was completely negating myself. I was sort of publicly negating myself, because I'm in order to be there, in order to be close to the wall, I had to say, I'm a guy. So I'm having all of these kind of contradictory and complicated feelings. And so I described that experience, and when I came back, everything had changed, and it was complicated. So one of the things about, you know, people, it's kind of like when you, as I understand it, when you have cancer, like everybody wants you to be one of the happy endings, right? You're going to have a positive attitude, you're going to do what the doctors say, and you're going to be fine. And it's kind of the same with transsexuals, right? People want to divide your life into, you know, the sucky part where you couldn't live as yourself, and then there's the confusing part where you're teaching people your pronouns, and then you live happily ever after. And I wasn't averse to living happily ever after, but at least when you do this in middle age, it's a lot messier than that. I think many of us who've lived to middle age know that whenever you make any major change in middle age, it's more complicated than you were miserable and now you're happy forever after. Right? So when I went back to Israel, I wasn't living with my children anymore. My marriage had broken up. I was living all alone. I had gone back to Yeshiva University, which was great. I was splashed across the New York Post, which was not feeling so great. In terms of my years of living as a woman, this was the beginning of year two. So if you think about developing a mature female identity, I would say in seventh or eighth grade. And most people don't really want their 7th or 8th grade in the New York Post. Julie reports to middle school. Look at her imitation of, you know, mature female garb. Right? It's kind of the spotlight was not my friend at that point. So I go there, and I'm walking through the streets, and I felt like, you know, now I'm here, and I'm myself. And when people see me, they are responding to me, you know, as they see a woman and they're responding that way, and that's identity affirming. And also, like, where are my kids? Right? Where's that sound that is always there? Like, it's never quiet, and you want to, like, could you shut up for a minute? And now it's like, you know, this is Jerusalem. It was busy, but to me it was like dead silent because I couldn't hear my children. And so I was feeling intensely the loss and intensely the miracle of this. I was, you know, I went to the souk, and I was, you know, sold something that for three times as much as it was worth by one of the Arab shop dealers. It was great, right? Because it's all this stuff based on, you know, that he was a guy and I was a woman, and he knows how to sell women, American women. And it's like, and I'm like, yeah, keep selling me, keep selling me. So he didn't even realize what I was getting out of the interaction was way more than a scar. And then I get to the wall, and I have this intense memory of being there with my family. And now I'm there as this person who doesn't have a family. This person who's been stripped of children, who's been stripped of history, right? The person I was, it only existed for a few months. And nobody in the entire country except my best friend knew who I was. And this time I went to the other side of the wall. I wasn't able to go without hesitating because, you know, there are all these women dressed in black. I have no idea how they do it, you know, head to foot in black under the blazing sun. They're very, very pious women. And I thought, you know, this is their sacred space. And part of the sacredness of the space is based on this gender division. I thought, the guys are not going to let me over there, even if I'm willing to say, you know, okay, according to halacha, I should still be classed as a guy, therefore I'll go to the men's side of the wall. Really, I'm not going to be welcomed over there. And if I came clean to these women, who I suspect, even if I spoke perfect Hebrew, probably didn't have a word for transsexual, I said, I'm a transsexual, and that's, here's what this means, and can I come to your side of the wall? They probably would have said no. Also, so now I have a choice. As a Jew, I'm entitled to go to the wall, right? Maybe I'm even obligated, but I'm certainly entitled. This is part of the core of my identity. But in terms of gender, the way the wall has been split into these two genders that are defined in Orthodox terms, I don't actually have any part of the wall where I'm welcome. And how do I respect the feelings of these women without exiling myself, cutting myself off, as the Torah would say, cutting myself off from my people? And then I realized that, you know, I needed to go. I needed to be there. And there were tons. It was like every middle school girl in Israel had been brought to the wall that day. So it took forever. And, you know, in one way, we were all like the same age, was my feeling. And so I'm waiting and I'm praying and I'm closing my eyes. And every time I open my eyes, I've been pushed a little bit closer. And when I get to the wall, I just start sobbing. And one of the things about being raised as a guy is it's pretty hard for me to cry. No matter how much estrogen I pump into myself, it's still really hard for me to cry. And I'd gone through so much. And in most of the times when I was out in public, I was really not supposed to show it, right? I was supposed to look like I was okay with everything. Not like, oh, I've transitioned and now I'm miserable, right? Nobody, that's not the way it's supposed to go. And so here I am sobbing, and I'm like, oh, this is terrible. I'm making a spectacle of myself. And I open my eyes, and of course there are other people sobbing also. Remember, this is the Wailing Wall, right? This is like the official, they should have hankies stuffed into the crevices instead of those notes. Because everybody is crying. On the women's side. On the men's side, they were celebrating something, probably a bar mitzvah or something like that. And I thought, you know what? I'm like totally on the right side of the wall. And there is a gender to which I 100% belong, and that is the gender of people with broken hearts. And an Orthodox woman who was also crying met my eyes, and we sort of smiled at one another through our tears. And I realized that there was a way in which I wasn't really, without making claims to really being a woman or really being this or really being that, I was really being myself among people who were really being themselves. And we were connected by things that were deeper than the gender binary goes. That meant that there was a way of being human that was before and beyond all questions of gender. So maybe that's the transition moment I would pick.
An extraordinary story. Oscar Wilde said, I mean, who was neither Jewish nor female, but...
but he had other good qualities.
Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, all other roles are taken. Are there things...
I just want to add, he also said, and this is should be the trans motto, only superficial people don't judge by appearances.
Bless his heart. He did a good job. I was so struck reading, I was struck by a lot in reading the book, but where you talk about how other people worry about who you are, and what that's about is really about what you mean to other people. So it's not about your identity, it's about what you signify. And there you were at the wall, just being. You know, it's sort of like what Heschel says about Shabbat, that it's just your time to be. You know, you're there in the moment. And to people who were sitting in judgment of you, the New York Post or Rabbi Tendler or that it was about what you mean in the world or meaning to others. Do you have a way of both expressing and dealing with the anger that that must engender? I mean, no puns. When you use the word engender, it's so tremendously useful.
Yeah,
but I found that a really marvelous, succinct formulation in the book, that you are about who you are, and to other people, it's about what you mean.
One of the, I think, smartest transphobic comments. So I've attracted some transphobic comments. I have to say that I've never had anyone at where I teach. None of my students, none of my fellow faculty or administrators, no one has ever treated me with anything but respect. So I've had very little compared to many out trans people. I've had very little face-to-face experience with transphobia, not none. But in print, I've managed to attract some pretty good passionate expressions of difficulty with transgender people. But the smartest that I've ever read was by Rabbi Moshe Tendler, and he's a dean of, I think, bioethics at Yeshiva University. And he is your go-to guy for transphobic or homophobic comments. If you're a New York journalist, know this, because it's actually hard to get people to go. It's not hard to find people who hate LGBT people. You can still, scare up a few. But it is hard to find them people who are willing to go on the record. But he is, and he's pretty happy to. So all the journalists have him on speed dial. But he said something that was pretty great. He said that he referred to me as he, said, I'm not a woman, I'm a male with enlarged breasts. I thought it was nice of him to see my breasts as large. The adjective that I've heard very much. But anyway, but he said that I represent a kind of amorality. And I think that that's the only time that the New York Post has ever published the word amorality. So he just single-handedly lifted the intellectual level of the entire publication. But when he said that, I thought, if he'd said immorality, that would not have been that interesting. It would have just been saying, there's good and there's evil, and you are on the evil side of it. But he said amorality, and what he was saying was, and it's very much like the pronoun thing, which as an English professor, I also have difficulties with this. So my son goes to Hampshire College, and when they begin a public event, they begin by asking people to say which pronouns they would like to be addressed by, and you wear a name tag with your pronouns. And people make up their own, and they change them from event to event. So I'm Glee right now. Please refer to me as Glee. And I'm like, okay, so I am such a 20th century transsexual. But this is a glimpse of what the world would be like if gender were understood to be something that was a matter of purely personal definition. So the way, for example, not men. For the most part, men's clothing choices are pretty rigidly socially constrained. But women in our culture have a very broad range of socially acceptable choices. So you don't have internal or external voices necessarily beating on you, unless your mom's around. Then you have. But otherwise, you have like this. You can just kind of pick from a wide range of clothes to express your sense of who you are and who you want to be that day. And in places like Hampshire, you get a sense of what it would be like if gender itself were understood in the same kind of way. That it's mutable and that it's up to every person to define it for themselves. And that isn't the way that I think most people experience gender. So that's kind of an extreme libertarian view of it. Gender identity, I do think, actually, is that way. So I have no way of looking at anyone here and knowing who you feel like you are to yourself in terms of gender. I know for a fact that when I was presenting as a guy, I had a gender identity that nobody could tell, and it didn't make any difference. You can't legislate gender identity. It's just what we say to ourselves about who we are. And I do think that that is, you know, in some ways it's fixed, in some ways it's mutable. We develop different senses of who we are at different times, but it's really, it's nobody's business but ours. It's just what we say to ourselves. Gender expression, however, how, you know, the way that we present and define our gender in the world, that's a totally public matter, and it's a linguistic matter, because what we're doing is making signs of identity. We're proclaiming ourselves to saying either I am this or that, or relate to me as though I were this or that, and there's a whole range of possibilities, and language is not purely individually determined. I mean, you can make up your own language, but you just don't get very far. Right? If you ask directions in your own language that nobody else speaks, you know, good luck with that. And you can get angry at people for not understanding or respecting your language, but they won't understand because you're expressing it in a language nobody else speaks. So if you want to use a gender language that is meaningful to other people, you're participating in an intersubjective system. And that means you're messing with other people. Right? So when I read, you know, I'm an English professor, so, and you're an editor, so when you read new words, right, English is amazing at creating new words, and some of them feel, like, horrible to me, and like, that's ugly, no, no, you can't do that, you know, what was it, somebody, I can't even remember, they had shortened a two-syllable word to one syllable as a 16-year-old, and they kept adding the extra syllable for me, it's like, oh, this is an old person. They won't understand unless I add the other syllable. And I'm thinking, I'm an old person. You are not allowed to do that to my language. So language, symbolic systems in general, this is something that we wrestle out together. And the truth is that, and this is, again, part of that kind of, there's anger across the political spectrum. There are people on the right, people on the left, and in the middle who are really upset by transgender women, I haven't experienced it from the men's side, because they're like, if you are a woman, if you get to present yourself as a woman, you are messing with what I mean when I call myself a woman. And you know what? I've suffered to be a woman, right? Being a woman to me has meant going through childbirth, or it's meant being raped, or it's meant being discriminated against, or it's meant being the first in my field and dealing with what that means, or it's meant, you know, being in a difficult marriage for 55 years to a man who really hates women. Whatever it is, you know, they're like, that word, that identity is pretty important to a lot of people. For other people, it doesn't matter at all. I was at a discussion where, it was at a Nehirim, queer Jewish women's retreat, and the discussion was whether they should take the term women out because it was so old-fashioned. And these, you know, these college kids were saying, yeah, I didn't even want to come to something called a women's event because it's like, who defines themselves in terms of gender anymore? And I and this other trans women were sitting there saying, and I think I said this aloud, you know, we just got here. Could you not eliminate the gender for a while? Like, it would be nice to get to feel like, you know, we're doing the woman thing before you decide it's passé. But the thing is that, you know, gender identities, they are things that we make, gender expression and the meaning of what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman, it's stuff we both do in within ourselves, and we do it with one another. And that is part of the kinds of anger, and it's more than anger, it's the visceral discomfort that people, some people experience with transgender people. Because among other things, what gender does is it says when you walk into a room, you identify some people as us and some people as not us. And the us is, it's a physical identification. I'm guessing here because I don't live in this system, but if you were born, raised, and identify as male or female, you walk into a room, say you're born, raised, and identify male, when you see other guys, you say, yeah, that's us. And by us, I mean these are people who share my body. When I think about my body in its most intimate details, it is like their bodies. That's what bonds us together. It's a deep, visceral bond and sense of belonging. And when guys look at me and they say, wait a second, you did what to my body? To my male body? It is upsetting. And I have to say, you know, I think I get the need to physically transition as well as anybody does. But when I meet trans guys who are just at the beginning of transition, I viscerally feel like, wait, you've got this great female body, and you're going to do what to it? You know, come on. Can't we negotiate here? So there are these levels of visceral identification of gender that, for some people, make it really, really hard to deal with trans people. And those are feelings that I both hear from the, you know, I can be the victim of those feelings, but I also get them from the inside, because I'm, you know, I'm born and raised in that system also. Now it's possible that your intern is starting to grow up in a world where those kinds of identifications are not fundamental to individual identity and to human relationships.
Well, of course, you know, this is generalizing from an N of one. The intern who said, yes, three of my closest friends are transitioning, I get it, you know, completely. Like, how 20th century of you to think that matters to me, you know. Can I have a blue pencil, please? I think we see only a limited spectrum of the world, as you point out. There's still plenty of actual hatred out there and danger. And I was speaking to a friend of mine in New York recently, a guy who's in his late 30s, early 40s. He and his partner have three kids, all under the age of 7, and they're raising them in a progressive Orthodox shul on the Upper West Side. These two guys and their two little girls and little boy, and the kids go to a Chabad nursery school, and they are completely active in their Orthodox congregation. And my friend says to me, only in this piece of the universe could we do this so comfortably, where our kids are completely accepted, where my partner and I are completely accepted. You know, so my intern from Holyoke is one, but there are shifts that I would love to ask you about. Clearly, these are subjects that we talk about all the time around our potluck lunch at Lilith Magazine, and lunch goes on for about 2 hours, and the first 30 minutes are, you know, spent discussing shredded raw beets, delicious. Your CSA has great kale this week. So, like, first we get through the food part, which is the really important part of the lunchtime conversation. And then we talk about batches of other things. So the other day I said, I had an experience in an elevator where one of my daughters lives in New York, where there's a little boy I've seen frequently, or if there's a child I've seen frequently elevated, like 4 years old, maybe 5 years old, and this kid is wearing sort of odd shoes that don't seem to fit him very well. So I'm looking at his shoes, and then I'm saying his shoes. I'm looking at the shoes on the child, and they're Mary Janes, and they're obviously a little too big. And wearing a dress and wearing really cute barrettes. And I can't remember how it started that I said something to his mother like, hello, or what really adorable barrettes. And the mother said, yeah, he really loves to wear his sister's clothes. And I've seen the child several times, and the child is wearing clothes that we would consider gender inappropriate for a little boy, and the little boy has chosen these clothes on his own. Four, maybe five. And what called attention to this, because the kid presented as female, the reason that I was looking at all, I mean, it's a very slow old elevator, so you have plenty of time to look, was that these shoes seemed the wrong size. Yeah, I mean, it's a middle-class building. It's not like the kid had to get the shoes at the Salvation Army in Nebuch. They you know, couldn't find secondhand shoes that fit. But that this was a choice to wear the Mary Janes of the sister. So I thought, great that the mother is allowing the child these gender choices, if they want to call them that, and then worrying about the kid. On the playground, the mother is calling the kid, but I can't remember, let's say the kid's name is John, you know, not a gender-ambiguous name. And what that's like for the child to then be presented with a somewhat hostile society. And the next day, and so we talk about that a little, and I'm very eager to hear your take on that. And the next day, our designer who lives in Park Slope says of herself in another context, she'll, I mean, I'm a Park Slope mother, of course. My son has dolls and wears pink, and, you know, it's like, of course, it would be scandalous if we, I mean, this I don't think that little boy was wearing skirts, but she says, but I have skirts. If he wants, he can wear, you know, tutus. So what happens when the outside world, composed often of parents less progressive than these, are dealing with their children's gender questioning, you know, the Q of LGBTQ, queer and questioning. And there's a piece in the current Lilith, which I think is on many of your chairs, a mother whose daughter is transitioning female to male and what her fears are for the daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I bring that to you as sort of a question for the outside world.
Well, I think it's really important, although maybe in D.C. you get to reminders of this all the time, but when we think of human history, we think of it as being homogenous in a certain way. This is the way people were then, this is the way people are now. But actually, that's never been the case. I have a friend whose parents in the 50s had a gay male couple who were friends, and they would sleep together in the same bed in the basement when they slept over. And that was a pretty homophobic era. So things are never as homogenous as we imagine. I think that I'm stunned. I continue to read a lot these days about parents who are supportive of gender variance in their children. They support play, and I want to speak a little bit to that, but I also want to remind people that we say LGBT and Q, and it sounds as though all of those things, all of those kinds of identity issues are living in the same kind of world. And they really aren't. And, you know, in the gay world, you'll often hear that, you know, lesbians and gay men are often living completely different kinds of lives and feeling different issues. There are different economics, issues of community, issues of violence. I mean, it's really different within that. But gay rights has made enormous strides, and trans rights has made some strides. I think we're up to the 70s by the gay rights spectrum now. So every week in the United States, 1 to 2 trans women are murdered. Okay, and on the Trans Day of Remembrance, we gather and we read out the names, and it takes a long time. Many of those people are trans women of color, because there are different communities that are more tolerant and there are communities that are less tolerant. If you are a trans woman who doesn't have access, who doesn't have enough money, who doesn't have insurance, or can't find a doctor who will help you transition, you are liable, you know, you are a walking target for violence, right? Because you're not going to present as a woman. People are going to see you as somebody who is mixing genders. And the thing that provokes the most violence in our society is male femininity, I think, even more than misogyny against women. When you see guys who are messing up masculinity, there are a lot of people who have very violent reactions to that. So in Massachusetts, liberal Massachusetts, the governor only a couple of months ago signed a bill that made it illegal for my landlords to throw me out because I'm trans. I didn't know if they knew that I was trans, although they're hearing my kids call me daddy all the time. I figured they probably did, and it was probably okay. But I also knew that if they didn't like it, they could throw me out, and it was fine. It is still not legal, even after that bill was signed, for me to use the women's room in a public place in Massachusetts. That had to be left out of the bill, or it couldn't get through the legislature. There are many states in which it's just not, there aren't any legal protections for trans people. So it's hard to keep this in mind, but part, you know, when I go through the world, I've had it pretty easy. And I was, you know, the worst things happened to me as I was harassed for 2 hours on a bus. And that was horrible and it was traumatic. But compared to what happens to some people like me, you know, the unemployment rate among trans people is unbelievably high. The percentage of kids who live on the street who are trans is incredibly high. We are a group of people who are in crisis, and the level of the society protecting us and caring for us and actually just recognizing us as part of us is still quite primitive in general. So, I, you know, you wouldn't know it from here, right? I get to be here, and I'm up here, and you guys look nice. You're not going to hit me. That's lovely. That doesn't mean you can't ask sharp questions, but it's a different world out there, and so I feel like it's important for me to say that.
Well, Joy, you had said, and we're going to make sure that there are time for questions, but you had said when we were speaking earlier that there are few trans women in the Jewish community who are spokespersons, who are speaking out, and we just feel very honored and lucky to have today you and Dana, so forthright, so thoughtful, so brilliant, so hardworking in bringing all these issues to a wider public. So
thank you. Really an honor to be sitting here with you.
How would you like us to handle the questions? Would you... Can we just recognize questions from the floor freely? And feel free to chirp in, please.
Formal
submission
procedure.
I'll repeat the question, by the way, briefly, if it's not clear. Please.
When you return to teaching... when you had completed, so to speak, your transition, do you feel that your teaching was any different when you looked at materials or books or your relationship to your students? Did you feel any difference in the way in which you taught or the materials you taught?
The question was, would you want to repeat the question?
Okay, so the question, and it's a great question, is when I returned to teaching as myself, did it change my relation to the materials I taught or the way that I taught? And the answer is yes, and it's something that I'm still working on. In some ways, I feel like, because I teach at an Orthodox Jewish women's college, in some ways I feel closer to my students because they live in all women worlds, and they respond to me sort of homosocially. So there's less of a sense of difference with the ones who choose to work with me than there was when I was a guy. But when I was teaching as a guy, I would often teach speaking very personally, which I think is important for literature in particular. There's a sort of museum case attitude toward it. And I feel pretty reluctant to do that now because I don't want to make my identity, my gender identity, an obstacle for students in the classroom. Like, to learn composition from me, you shouldn't have to, you know, be trans-friendly. Right, you're paying tuition, I'm your teacher, the classroom needs to be a safe and comfortable environment, and our teaching relationship should be about you, it shouldn't be about me. So all of that is true, and at the same time, I feel like, in a way, I'm not able to bring as much of myself into the teaching process, and I think that that's impeded my teaching.
Yes.
No pun intended, but it really is a joy to hear you for the second time. I was at that text study at Ron Institute for a totally different experience. In a way, your experiences have been a special vantage point for Lilith and its approach over the years because the struggle for women of the wall or... You've been in both places. You've been able to stand in both places, and that's a whole other piece of, you know, where we're all traveling and what you teach us. Two questions. One, as a very strong straight ally for LGBTQ now, rights, do you think, and I know Dana would have feelings on this pretty strongly, I'm sure, but do you think that the emphasis on marriage and all the GL rights push and all the attention and struggles in the last few years has in some way usurped the attention for, let's say, your rights, and will that battle just take its rightful place later on and get stronger? And the other question is much more personal. As somebody who struggles with whatever, I think I've come a long way, and I struggle with whatever's left in me in terms of my discomfort levels. I'm 90% pretty okay where I've traveled in terms of getting used to a variety of situations. And when I worked with a woman about 30 years ago, and she was a trans woman in the ladies' room, and I chat with people, I realized all these years that I never, just as I am speaking with a black person, I never in my mind let go of that person's past in my relationship with them. It just sits there. And I think that that may show, even though I'd like it to go away.
I'm just going to stop you. If you could formulate it as a question, because we have so little time.
What does it matter? Can you see that in us who struggle to be better people? And does it matter to you? Is it noticeable?
So, yes, has the push for marriage equality siphoned off resources for all kinds of other LGBT stuff? Yes. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not really qualified to say, but I will. One way that is bad is that there's very, very little money now for homeless LGBT youth services, and that is a true crisis. I mean, we're really abandoning our children in that respect. So in terms of the other question, you know, I'm a member, you know, I'm a fully acculturated member of a racist, classist, sexist, I'm leaving out a bunch of ages. There's a whole bunch of prejudices that are just, they're part of me. They're never going away. And I think that that's a normal human thing. I think that we, because we always define who we are in terms of who we're not, it is very, very, I don't think there's been a human society that hasn't been stratified and had these kinds of cross-cutting hatreds and identifications. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think that it's something that we're all working to overcome. But for me personally, you know, so I live in the world as a trans person, and that means that I am, part of my identity is the before and after, right? It's not the way that I want it to be. Like, I didn't want to be, I didn't say, oh, God, please make me a transsexual when I grow up. But, you know, that's who I am. It's what I am, and it's who I am. And because of various circumstances, including the fact that I wasn't willing to walk away from my kids, when I'm on playgrounds, my little one calls me daddy all the time. I mean, that's the, every other word is daddy. So I have to be who I am, and who I am is this combination of before and after. I think Jews struggle with this. I think immigrant people who come from immigrant families struggle with this. What's the relationship of the present self to the past self? And I think that different people answer that in different ways. So I think that there are trans people who, they're like, no, this is, I am a man, I am a woman, what you see is what you get. And there are other people who feel differently about it. But I think what I felt like I've been learning is that my challenge is to recognize humanness in all of its forms, right? So I am a form of humanity. I'm an unusual form of humanity. There are a lot of unusual forms of humanity. And sometimes when I see people, I don't recognize them as human. I just see what strikes me as strange. And I need to know that when I see somebody who doesn't strike me as human, I'm just like, whoa, what's that? But I've got some work to do.
Well, and there's a wonderful line, excuse me, in the Hertz translation of the Torah, which says, to the Torah, nothing human is alien.
Yes.
So great. I think we have time for another, can we take another two questions?
Two more questions. But I know there's many questions.
Okay.
And Joy will be happy to sign.
These were two hands up before, so one and two, and then we'll invite people to talk to Joy as she signs books.
Part of what I've been grappling with that will be useful later is recognizing the cohort differences of age and life experience as well as gender. I am so far removed from the experience of any graduate at Holyoke that we might as well be some different. But I did want to ask if I'm hearing you correctly and where you see your own evolution in that of being like yourself. But the only reference to feminism and anything you said was to see it as hostile to you. And when you spoke about going to the wall, I don't go to the wall anymore because
organization that controls that holy space does not acknowledge my right to be there as my full religious Jewish female self. And I heard you happy to be in that world for your historical reasons, but not identifying with those of us who struggle to get a place on the bus that the rabbis don't want us to have, to be able to wear a tallit at the wall. So how do you see yourself either approaching or denying or absorbing the whole issue of feminism?
Well, I don't think you heard me not identifying. I think you heard a particular moment in my transition. But I think that part of what makes some people angry about trans women is that a lot of the stuff that people who are born and raised and identify as female work very hard to throw off the tyranny of are things that trans women, who often have a repressed delight in femininity, embrace. So for me, femininity is a language of authentic self-expression, but I have friends who are like, you want to wear clothes? Like, what? I mean, I would never wear that stuff. That was what I was forced to wear when I was a little girl, and I haven't worn anything but pants ever since. No, please let me finish. So, you know, I am furious about the misogyny, and it's growing misogyny, you know, because in the ultra-Orthodox world, everything is imagined as historically continuous. But this is totally ahistorical. This is new stuff, and it keeps changing and then being projected back into the past. To me, that is an affront against women. It's an affront against me as a Jew. It's an affront against God. I'm not okay with it in any way, shape, or form. I teach in an Orthodox Jewish school, and one of the things that I see is Orthodox Jewish women who are incredible human beings, despite being Orthodox. So when I got there, that's the way I thought of it. I thought there are going to be all these poor, benighted, stunted souls, and thank God they'll have me, right? Because I come from the world outside the little misogynist ghetto that they grow up in. And instead, what I've come to see is, do they experience misogyny? Absolutely. They also experience other things, and things that enable them to be pretty amazing women. And I actually didn't grow up Orthodox, so I can't speak to what they are living, but it's made me realize that the Orthodox world is, even in terms of gender, is much more complex. That doesn't make my feelings about the fact that my students who have forgotten more than I will ever learn about Judaism are not counted in the minyanim that they have. That's like insane to me, right? Ignorant 13-year-old boys who've never been in a synagogue, they count, but my students don't. I mean, this is insanity to me personally. At the same time, I respect their culture, the culture that keeps giving me these incredible young women. So there's something that is complicated in my relationship with them. I considered myself a feminist from, you know, really my college years, and I was just moderating a panel on trans feminism, and no, I don't exactly know what that is, but there are real questions about the relationship of trans women to feminism, and I have kind of tried to not claim women's identity for myself, to say things like I am living as a woman, which I think is a statement of fact, rather than say I am a woman. Because I know that there are these kind of, you know, there are some people for whom that feels like a violent appropriation of their own identity. So, do I think women should be treated as human beings? Yeah. Do I think that that's as crucial in Judaism as outside of it? 100%. Am I very honored to be, you know, seen as feminist and welcomed in feminist areas? Yes. Do I feel like I have the right to anoint myself as this or that? I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, some people would say absolutely. I feel like my job is more to, my personal work in the world is more to learn about the many different passionate ways people see these issues and to be respectful of them and to sort of be at the intersection of them rather than, you know, make a firm place for myself. Maybe in later, when I've grown up a little bit more, maybe I'll be in a different place.
You describe yourself as in adolescence in this wonderful
yeah.
book. One last question, please.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've shared and all the nuance. I really appreciate it. Where do you see yourself fitting into the Judaism spectrum? How does Judaism inform your life, and has it changed since the transition?
One of my friends is Rabbi Jill Hammer, who's a really wonderful Jewish thinker, and we were talking about our Jewish upbringings, and she said, "Oh, you're a feral Jew too," and that was like such a great term for me. So, as a feral Jew, I was somebody who my family was culturally Jewish but not religiously Jewish, and that turned out to be great for me because I didn't have anybody to tell me what Judaism was. Or what God was and how much God hated me, right? Instead, I read the Torah and I kind of made up Judaism from there. It's like, well, yeah, that's Bronze Age Hui. This is really good, right? It was the Hertz, you know? So I kind of cobbled together a Judaism that enabled me. The thing for me that's the most essential thing about Judaism for me has been the idea that Jews are in a constant, intimate argument with God. That we always, that there isn't really anything between us and God, and also that we're not working to merge into God, right? Moses never has a moment of not arguing with God, right? They're like an old married couple. They never just stop. Their human and the divine viewpoint are different, and in Judaism, that difference is something that is sacred. So to me, that was always the heart of it. My students have really been teaching me about the ethical dimensions, the ethical heart of Judaism. I always felt like not a human being. So that part of Judaism, the part of the bonds between human beings and that being a mode of being sacred, and I knew I was supposed to be a good person, but I didn't get that in the way that I see when my students transcend my otherness to relate to me. So I haven't found any form of Judaism that doesn't have some things that I can admire in it that I've personally experienced. And I've never found one that I feel totally at home in. And maybe that makes me like a good Jew. I'm not sure. Right? That's like the joke about the desert island where you're marooned on a desert island and you build two synagogues, so there's always one you can refuse to enter.
On that cheerful note, thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you.